Right. It was very wide ranging. Like he would start with something, we would start with something, and then go on to a different topic.
But you're absolutely right, DB. The what he ex what you talked about in that video that we tried to share there is extremely honest.
Yeah, I've been talking a bit with Just Collapse about this geoengineering project here in on the West Coast. I don't know if you saw my post about it, about having a plastic curtain across a
Yes,
5 kilometer
it's
fjord.
terrifying.
So I think it was interesting, and I'm gonna try and work some more with Just Collapse on it because they are the experts where they've been for half a year or so. So the interesting thing is that if you view it from a what's in it for us locally perspective, there's actually nothing in it for Greenlanders because exactly where the ice runs ground or where it stops because it's shallow, that ice bank, that's the richest f fisheries in all of Greenland, and fisheries in its turn is the biggest part of the economy for Greenland. And this curtain that they presented here in Nuuk on Monday is even a Teflon covered curtain, and Teflon is something you really shouldn't have in your pants on your stove because it's toxic. So you'd get tons and tons of microplastics from the curtain, from every ins and out of the tides and stuff, or the waves and storms and such stuff. And it would disturb the whales. The whales are a big part of tourism up there. Every time you go down to the beach, you see a whale, basically. That's what I did when I was up there. And again, you get toxic particles in your food because Greenlanders eat a lot of seabirds and fish and snow crabs and even whales. So it's the sort of the rich white man's solution for their own problems. But for us locally, it's only added to the problems. So I think that's pretty interesting.
And that Teflon curtain is just because they want to slow down the melting. That's just their solution, is it? It's just what opposition are they meeting?
Well, the entire this part of the project is actually quite good in the sense that it's investigating or checking out what people think locally. So they actually say that there's no guarantee that we will ever do this. It's just the first part of the project to have these meetings with people in on the west coast of Greenland. But it's anyway, the way if you look at it at the whole picture, it's like Chinese people and European people, I'm sure American people as well, wanting to save their biggest cities from flooding from the ice melt. So they have something to gain from it, but in Greenland, because of loss of gravity pull on the ocean, when the ice sheet melts down, we get lower sea levels around Greenland, and also because of glacial rebound, the land sort of comes up again after being pushed down by the ice. So we will actually see hugely lower sea levels around Greenland. So it's kind of a perfect case of somebody far away wanting to solve their own problems and coming up here and creating more problems for us. So.
Oh, Sophie, I think you're muted.
I said it's hard when we don't have a topic, and also the absence of Hugh after seeing him. It just even you even feel the void of not inspiration, but yeah, maybe inspiration. It's possible. It's going to be like this, I think, with the Extinction Atty, because we're going to have these kind of moments, which are not necessarily bad, actually.
I think this whole topic is a good thing to go off of, though, because one thing I notice when it comes to a number of these guests and some of the folks that the Extinctionati have interviewed is a lot of them seem to think that there's coming this sort of movie style, like apocalypse or something, where all of a sudden the ice sheet's going to go out in one day, and all of the governments and all of the establishments and the powers that be will be completely caught off guard and not able to do anything about it. And then, you know, collapse is just sort of a big sort of sudden thing that happens. But I see it much more in.
Yeah. Right. It was very wide.
This paradigm ends in some kind of big event. But I think it's much more this kind of stuff, the dragging it out, the crazy ideas to try to stop nature from doing what it does, you know, Teflon curtains and all this nutso stuff. But yeah, I think it's much better to think about the threat posed by the reactions of the powers that be, as opposed to, I think humans are a much bigger enemy than nature is. Let's put it that way, I guess. The human's reaction to what nature is doing is much more dangerous and, affecting in the short term, at least.
Yeah. I was actually reminded while I was, at this popular meeting for this curtain project, that I think it's like now it's like 8 years ago. Then I actually put an application for the job as NATO Secretary General, just for fun, you know. why wouldn't you? So I actually applied for that job the same year as. The current Norwegian head of NATO, and of course my policies for NATO would be very, very different. So I go into things like building walls in Antarctica to stop the glaciers and stuff. But that's it's funny to watch again, because it's 8 years ago, and my thinking of in these areas has developed a lot, because back then I wanted to, you know, stop it from happening, and now I'm like, can it happen faster? Can it go faster than this? So the interesting thing that Gary said last or at the interview was the stuff about that we also talked about 2 weeks ago, that it seems like the ordinary people, the normies, they are driving this as fast as humanly possible. So it's like even with you still among us, I don't think we could have figured out a way to make things go faster. You just have to look around at your family and friends on Facebook and stuff, and see how much they travel to other continents and stuff for holiday, and you know, all the time it's like pictures of Spain or whatever in your feed. So it's like eco freaks like us. What can we come up with that will accelerate collapse faster than it already is? I don't think that's possible, to be honest.
I don't think so either. I think, I don't know who said it, but someone said, you know, if you were to literally try to design a system that would burn through as many sort of non-renewable resources as possible, you honestly could not come up with a better system than the one that exists in terms of increasing the human population, making billions of consumers out there, everything. I mean, you on it, every aspect of the system functions to serve that purpose. You really couldn't make it any better. I totally agree. But I think thinking about this stuff and how one acts in one's own life shouldn't be guided by what the outcome's going to be, but rather sort of what's right. And I think that ties into what we're talking about here. When it comes to grief, like DB was saying, I had a really good comment here. In the book, the main character suffers the worst loss anyone could imagine. So maybe in that case, you know, it's the destruction of the earth, or not destruction, but, you know, the ending of this sort of version of the world. And a big part of the story is a cycle of grief he goes through that never leaves, but he does go through catharsis, and part of it was getting revenge on the man who took everything away from him. So when it comes to sort of how do you deal with it, or what do? I think this is all psychological, but it's sort of affirming that you know, what's going on is not right, and standing against it, not because you're going to make any difference in acceleration or anything like that, but rather just for your own sort of psychological way of dealing with the grief, because it can be paralyzing, and you can go down all kinds of loops and stuff in your own head with you know, all the different layers of despair or whatever. But I think, yeah, like DB was saying, and like Hugh says in that grief video, that the best way to deal with that stuff is to do something against it. And I don't think there's any specifically correct way of doing that. It would depend on the person. But just, it's kind of hard to explain, but just sort of taking a stand in whatever way you can against it in your daily life. And I remember Hugh saying that could be the smallest things, you know, sign that says don't step on the grass, and then you just go step on the grass, or, you know, parking only for 15 minutes or whatever, stay 20, that kind of thing. Not because it's making any difference in the long run, but just for your own psychology. I think that's a critical point to try to tie together this conversation with the grief video. Does that make sense? Do people understand what I'm getting at?
But I think also exploring the finer or exploring the different scenarios or things in our future is can be handy, because, for instance, you know, when REM sings about it's the end of the world as we know it, you know, that's kind of a reference to civilized industrial society, right? Mm-hmm. So, and when that goes away, we're left with nature and a kind of pre or post industrial age, or post civilized age, and this guy, Michael Dowd or something, on YouTube, he talks about his wife is one of the most ardent traffickers of plant species. So she traffics them from Florida and stuff, and up to about as far north as they can go and live. So what she's doing, and he's maybe doing also, and I'm considering it, is to sort of prepare for the, not afterlife, but the post civilized life with helping the trees that will be able to grow up here in Greenland, for instance, or where you live, or, you know, to help the trees walk, in a way, as the Indians would say. So, you know, instead of maybe trying to stop the inevitable collapse of civilization, maybe you, the one thing that keeps you sane could be something like, you know, preparing a tree cover of plants and trees that used to live much further south, and help them to live where you are or where you are going or something. That kind of preparation of the next century or something. Maybe that makes sense, I don't know.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. That's all, as you said, it's all tied up to the individual and to your circumstances, and it's you can't have a solution or a recipe for everyone. You know, it brings back to me, I just pulled out there the book, Hugh's book, St. George and the Methane Dragon, and there was I could remember at some stage he talks about what we're talking about when his the guy Dean starts to explain about the flipping, but it says somewhere Frank Sinatra might have some as far as the late 80s, governments had already secretly found the answer to the dilemma posed by the limits to growth. There really was no point in capping greenhouse gas emissions or suffering economic austerity. As the logic went, if overshoot, collapse, and a mass die-off were inevitable, then why not just simply embrace the collapse? Frank Sinatra might have summed it up with, before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have that chance, let's face the music and dance. Except that the elites had no intention of facing the music. And then he goes on to examples, and then he starts saying, by 2020, walls and barriers were rapidly going up all over the world, legal, physical, digital, trade, fiscal, and migratory, all a globally coordinated part of the Midway's doctrine, the restaurant.
Right. It was very wide-ranging, like he would start with.
All our attempts to mitigate or to try to, how do you say, how would I put it? I'm so tired that I'm losing my, can somebody take over? Because I'm after reading.
Yeah, I think to try to tie it together and to tie it to Thorstein, I think the system, if you want to talk about the sort of managed extinction system or the global industrial system, the alien cortex system, whatever you want to call it, is against life, and it's for turning live things dead and burning stuff. It's basically turning the whole world into, you know, dead ash and stuff like that. And so to do anything that affirms life in the face of that, if it's, you know, defying that system in the form of the law, if it's defying the debt system, if it, any defiance of that kind of system is a life-affirming defiance. So the same thing would go for planting trees or adopting pets or anything like that, to be pro-life, not in the conventional sense of the term, but to be for life in the face of the system that is pro-death is maybe another way to think about all of it. Again, not with the idea that, you know, you have to save 100 lives in your lifetime or 1,000 trees or anything like that, but to just do what you can whenever you can to be life affirming is, I think it's the right way to do it, and it's good for your own psychology in the defiance of this destructive system.
Yeah, I usually think, I've been thinking for some years that people are wrong simply when they say that climate change is a problem, because to me anyway, overshoot is the problem, overshoot in all its forms and consequences, and in that context, climate change actually becomes a solution mm-hmm. to the overshoot problem. And we've also been talking about Mother Earth, sort of being at the wheel, being behind the wheel, and sort of naturally managing the end of the overshoot. And I think that also makes it kind of easier to be on the side of an early collapse, because it's not so herself of the overshoot. So that therefore I think it's easier to go with the collapse. That didn't make the recording, but that's okay.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It's a natural reaction to actions that have been taken. It's one of the only universal laws we really know, is that there is an equal and opposite reaction to every action taken, and everything done by humans there will be a reaction to that. It's you can look at it however you want. You could look at it as good or you could look at it as bad, but it still is what it is at the end of the day. It's a law way beyond us, our will. So
yeah, it reminds me of maybe 10 years ago I was talking with some people about whether or not agriculture was sustainable, sustainable in the old unmolested sense, where it can go on and on, and not the Brundtland United Nations sense that was favorable to growth economy. So the thing is that it seems to us like agriculture is sustainable because it takes a long time before it collapses, before it crashes to the ground, like we see now, right? So I liken that to one of the earliest pioneers who tried to fly by jumping off a cliff with some plastic wings or something, back in the 1910s or around there. And it's kind of the same thing, only that takes only 10 seconds before you crash to the rocks below and die. But you can imagine for yourself that you are flying, you have invented the first flying machine during those 10 seconds. So the only difference between those two, because both the plastic wings of this guy and the agriculture as sustainable are wrong, or just unsustainable. So sooner or later it will crash and burn. It just seems to us humans living on the short lives that the 10,000 years of agriculture is forever.
Well, Hugh used to say that overshoots happened at the time of the American Civil War. So we've been flying for quite a while now, the last few generations, and haven't we?
Yeah, and interestingly, because we mentioned the Vikings series on Netflix in the previous conversation we had here, and what I was going to say there was that the main reason that at least some of the Vikings in West Norway went out and plundered and occupied and fought wars and stuff was that West Norway was already in overshoot. They'd figure out how to have cattle and have agriculture and stuff, and they were so successful at it, and they couldn't feed all their children, and that's kind of the only reason they left wonderful Norway for England and the Western Islands, is because they had reached their ecological limit, so they had to spread out like a cancer, like humans always do. So that's kind of the back history of why the Vikings did what they did. It's not an excuse, but it's just so that that we know that we've been in overshoot since the 800s, the 800s. Yeah.
Yes, because what stopped them in France, where I grew up, and I learned that in history because I grew up in a part of the country called Normandy, And the history of that place is that the King of France, to stop the Vikings from plundering the rest of France, gave Normandy to the Viking king of the time, and they settled in Normandy. And then they stopped because they had land, and they could have cattle, and they could have, there were great land, very lovely for cows and agriculture. So they settled there, and that was it.
Yeah, and I actually kind of solved the big Greenland mystery half a year ago, because the same reason that I went to England and Scotland and Ireland and Iceland and stuff is the same reason I went to Greenland initially, and they were there for like 500, 600 years or something. And every scholar and academic paper in the world is kind of scratching their head and saying, oh, how did they disappear? What happened? What happened? So I was just looking at the picture of the last wedding in a church in West Greenland, that is on all over the internet. And the last guy to marry in Greenland had my name, Thorstein. So, but the thing is, he was an Icelandic fisherman. So the first thing they did after they married and he was allowed to kiss her and stuff was to go straight back to Iceland, you know. And this is the last sort of dated that we know the date and the year for when this happened, in the 1340s or something, or 1320s, I don't know. So of course this is the age of the Black Death, the big pest, and the presence of this Icelandic fisherman at this wedding in Greenland at that time, that tells you that they had news from Iceland and Norway. They had connection over the sea, right? And I think that everybody who lived from Norway to Shetland to Iceland to Ireland and to Greenland spoke the same language, and they were actually in the same kingdom. They paid taxes to the same king, right? So what do you do when you hear that half the farms in Norway and Iceland are empty because of the plague? Well, of course you go back. You go back to Iceland and Norway. So there's no mystery at all. It's just they got news that there was no longer any reason to be in Greenland because there was plenty of free land to retake home in Norway and. Yeah.
Right. It was very.
I think I'm maybe the only guy who figured that out. Everybody is sort of still asking themselves the question. And if you look at Wikipedia for Greenland disappearance or depopulation or something, they're still sort of scratching their head and having three different theories and stuff. Maybe they went to America, maybe they were captured by Spaniards, or, you know. It's kind of stupid because these people just moved to better areas.
There was also a theory too that some historians wrote about the fact that the most of the people in Greenland who was still having a sort of agriculture, who kept cows and who had to do it in a very, very difficult conditions, and they were entirely dependent on sea connections with Northern Europe. And when, for different reasons, in Europe, war, illness, whatever, the sea connection was interrupted, a lot of those little farms and colonies died. And some, as you say, go away. I mean, I don't know if you know about that theory too, but
Yes, that's kind of the mainstream, at least in Norway,
oh, is it?
that
Okay, I didn't know it.
they found knives and axes and stuff which were used until there was no metal, no blade left almost. So it indicated that they'd been without contact or without trading contact with Norway for quite a long time. So they didn't get new supplies and new metal and new knives and stuff. And yeah, so this is it's a long debate, long story. But basically, it's very hard to drive a farm here in Greenland compared to, let's say, Denmark or Scotland or Norway. So it's as long as you still have family ties and stuff in those other areas of the kingdom, for instance, in Iceland, then it's almost like a newspaper or you know, a news feed that you have this giant farm over there in East Greenland that is free and nobody living there. So of course you go there, you take your newly wedded wife and go and settle there, because there are no people, there's no people there. So basically the old problem of the overshoot was solved almost by the plague, and therefore they could return, right? So that's my interpretation anyway, my top theory.
Yeah, but tying into overshoot, you see, it's nearly the same thing as nowadays. Like, okay, except that nowadays there's only guys like Elon Musk or thing like that think they're going to go onto another planet or, you know, to start a new colony because they fucked up the Earth so much that nobody will be able to live on it. But it's these people continue to apply agriculture, industry. They didn't consider 1 minute watching the hunter-gatherers around them, how they lived, and trying to imitate them. They wanted to continue their techniques and their, you know, it was it's nearly the same. That overshoot is actually we're nearly talking about the same thing as today.
I think it really is the same thing. It's the alien cortex sort of at the heart of all of it, thinking linearly, thinking in terms of growth, all that. It's like any kind of sort of what would you call it, genetic flaw or whatever in a species. Some species throughout history had a certain trait that led them to reproduce too quickly for the environment around them, and nature just kind of corrects for that. It corrects in all different kinds of ways, but it's shooting 100% when it comes to correcting for unsustainability. So yeah, it's all the same thing. But yeah, I think you can find the antidote for a lot of that. At least it helps me. I know Hugh would always talk about the antidote for that being things like Catalonia 1937 or whatever it was, or some of these other societies that sprung up in crises. But at least for myself, it really helps to think about the antidote for that being, like Sophie, you're saying, the hunter-gatherer types, to read how folks like the Piraha and stuff thought about the world, because they didn't do the same thing. A lot of those folks lived in the same place for tens of thousands of years with no overshoot, or if there was overshoot, it was maybe limited to this place or that place. But by and large, you know, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of generations of essentially the exact same thing. And yeah, that's where I think you can really learn a whole lot of lessons. If there's one thing I wish Hugh had talked about more, it was sort of those types of folks and how they saw the world. Because yeah, I just think there's so much to learn, and it's such an opposite view on the world as what we have in the West, and the common view that all of these civilizations and empires and stuff that always crash and burn have. Yeah.
Well, the overpopulation not only is from the agriculture, but settlement. So if you settle and you're farming, you can have like 6 kids. And if you're a hunter-gatherer, a woman can probably only carry 1 baby or 2 when they're nomadic and moving around. I'm not sure exactly, but I can imagine you can't have 6 kids if you're like one man, one woman can't sit there and have 6 kids in hunter-gatherer, because you can't, you know, transport or carry all those babies with you when you're trying to follow the herd. So.
Yeah, no, I think all of those kinds of natural factors were what limited it. A lot of people like to try to think, you know, what were their practices or what was a rule that we can implement, like, you know, China one child policy or whatever. It doesn't work. What you're doing is imposing the alien cortex on nature. Just the natural lifestyle that those folks lived just meant that, yeah, you couldn't have, like you're saying, six mouths to feed. You could not feed six children if, you know, you're living day to day, you know, seeing what food you can get. Some of them would just literally starve. So, yeah, nature would impose the limitations there.
Yeah, it's because you have to move if you're a hunter-gatherer and follow your prey. It's funny too because like a lot of people think that the dynamic in a wolf pack is oppressive, where only two wolves can have cubs. But that's not like it's not a dominance thing. They can only feed one litter of cubs, and even like half of them die because it's not easy following elk around and hunting them. So, and also prevents inbreeding too. But yeah, it's not oppressive. They can't feed multiple litters of cubs in one wolf pack, so that it's a practical issue too.
My experience with nomadic people was with tribes in the Sinai Desert with Bedouins, and these people have been living there since for thousands and thousands of years. They populate, well, of course, they lived there when their ancestor was probably living there when it was quite still fertile and green, but the people I know are adjusted to life in the desert, and they know they're semi-nomadic, which means that they leave camps with women and children usually, and they go around doing their thing, whether it's trading or doing things that are not always very honest, or else fishing in the Red Sea, or doing all sorts of businesses and stuff nowadays. But the thing that I learned from them was just how much they love their life, and how much they would not, they, how much, how little they own. They have no material possessions. They have no idea of ownership of land or property. There's no limits on, even if there's tribes, there's about 32 or 37, I can't remember, tribes in the Sinai. Each of them has a name and a chief, but there's no hierarchy. There's no limits. The tribes know where they have wells and beaches and you know, but it doesn't mean that it's my place and you can't come onto my place. You know, it's just because traditionally that's where they settle their tents. And when they sometimes have little gardens, because they have sometimes, they're not, it's difficult to be a gatherer in the desert because you need sometimes help to help a little bit to grow a few things, but they move their gardens around. They don't stay in a place. Yeah.
Right.
Part of, example, I remember being on the beach one day with one of the old men, and we were looking across, and we could see Saudi Arabia across, and they are the same origin, the same language, the same culture. And I was saying, oh, do you ever go over there? He said, no, it's full of idiots. I said, why? Because look at them. They don't know how to ride a camel. They can't make bread in the desert. They can't find their way with the stars. They're total idiots. And you know, that's the way they look at humanity in general. And they were staring at the lights across, that they were starting to see lights, because it was very obscure at the beginning when I went there. But it started to have, because the Saudis were building terminals and stuff across, and they can see that world closing upon them. But they just, like, nobody can survive where they live anyway, because the Sinai, if you don't know the desert, you know, if you're dead. Like the tourists from Egypt who go down there, if they don't have a guide, they'll just die of hunger, thirst, cold, or whatever, because it's very high. So it's, but they are totally in communion with their world. They know where to find wood if they need to make a fire, but they will always take a dead branch off a tree. They know how to, Yes, to bake bread with the sand under the sand, you know, when the sand gets very hot, they put their bread underneath. I've eaten some, so I've seen how it is. They sleep outside a lot. They don't own anything. Their possessions sometimes is a watch, a change of clothes, and now a mobile phone, because they have them now. But you could put what they have in their, I've been into their tents and into their huts, and you could put anything they have in a little bag, and that's all they possess.
Well, that's inherent to that lifestyle, isn't it? If you're living nomadically, you only can have what you can literally carry on your back. Otherwise,
And it's
you
the
wouldn't.
same with the children, because there's no rules. It's just an automatic regulation that comes from from centuries of tradition, knowing they know that a lot of women don't live, the couples don't live together very much. They don't see each other very much, so the opportunities for sex are obviously diminished. They have children, they go back to see the wife now and again, but it's not. They don't cohabit really much, and the women have a parallel life to the men. A lot of the women live on the north coast, which is milder, near the Med. A lot of the men are inside or in the South Sinai, and they go back and over, camels, cars, horses, whatever. So they can live apart for months. So there is automatically family planning there. The young men I met, the men that would be in their 20s to 30s, would be in age of marrying. A huge majority of them would not marry when I was there, because there was starting to be war or problems in the north with some Islamists. They considered that as very bad time to have children. So we're not going to get married, even though the mothers were, oh, you have to get married. But they were saying, no, we're not having children. No, it's not a good time for having children. It was not, because they just had made a decision. They knew exactly what they, actually, it's amazing to see how a guy of 18 would be talking to you like a man of 50 that had already got all an idea of the world. He knew exactly, you know. And yeah, so the children regulation is, I suppose, I guess, with the Pirahas and with other hunter-gatherers is of the same nature. It's not a rule. It's something that you know, because it's survival.
Yeah, it's less the way I think about it. The world you live in and we all live in here in the West, and it mostly goes for the entire globe at this point, is a world where the laws that govern all of your actions on an everyday basis are the laws of the alien cortex. So it's laws that are written into stone. Literally, they're written into the Constitution, they're written into all this stuff, and that in all of its manifestations, that governs your actions on a day-to-day basis. In those types of societies, in those environments, it's sort of the opposite. The laws that are governing you are just the laws of nature. And it's not to say that they didn't sort of come up with their own customs and traditions and some of the taboos and whatnot, but it's more like those things developed organically out of living under the constraints of nature. GB says laws are the Leviathan's ways, they're not life ways. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the Leviathan being the global industrial system that we live under, the alien cortex system. But yeah, the things that governed everyday behavior were just natural rather than alien cortex derived. I find that that's sort of the easiest, simplest way of looking at it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that
Yeah,
makes
it.
sense. And it was also interesting that what you described, Sophie, was that the Sinai people or the desert people were semi-nomadic, because I remember in one of those series of videos that Lord Hugh had, he was saying that the real, I don't know, in my mind, that the real boss that maintains civilization is the female sex, because it's very hard for women to not have a camp, to like DB said, you know, to carry offspring while traipsing around and moving about. So that's just very interesting. And to MM's point about the loss of nature and the loss of the ilian cortex. Like, I know I read one time that there's natural family planning built in also in unindustrialized societies, because they allow their baby, their toddler, to suckle and breastfeed until about 4 years of age. So while that's going on, they can't reproduce because that's just the way our bodies are. So there's that natural family planning built in also in their practices of rearing children.
Yeah, there's all kinds of natural regulating mechanisms. The biggest thing is to just get the alien cortex out of the way. That's the only thing messing everything up.
Yeah, it reminds me of one of the questions from the lake in the Mahabharata, where, like, I think it was like the lake or Brahmin or whatever asked him, what is madness? And then Yudhishthira is like, a forgotten way.
Yeah, it's an upside down world. It's an inverted world. Sanity is labeled insanity and vice versa.
One day when I was walking with some of those Bedouins I was telling you about sanity, we were walking along the beach as usual in the morning, and I came suddenly to that kind of heart. Well, they all lived in, they had some shacks that they would just leave and go like fishermen's places. But there was one place that had been completely done up. There was kind of bricks and mortar, and there was a rope in front, and there was tree, well, palm trees planted around. And I said, "What's that?" Oh, he said, "No, that guy is crazy." And I said, "What do you mean?" "But he's mad. He's put a door and he's put a fence around his place, you know." And for them, that was insanity. That guy was crazy. He had probably traveled and seen that people put a fence around the place. So then, and that's how they all called him mad, like he was just insane.
Yeah, you could see from that perspective too, because like nature doesn't see the borders and boundaries of the alien cortex as legitimate. That's why like wild animals always cross fences into farms, because that shit, it's just an illusion basically. People put a fence up and think, oh, this is going to keep you out, and it's like, no, it's not. That fence is illegitimate.
Anyway, for us city folks, we can't really go back to that right now.
Well, this city that I live in is already like that. Because the Greenland law is that the land, every piece of land belongs to everyone, like the state or the government or to you and me. So that means that even here in the city center, there are no fences, because they would actually by law be.
Right. It was very wide ranging, like he would start.
Cheeky, why naughty people? Why are they doing that? Are they thieves or no? It's everybody does it because everybody knows that every square meter of outside area belongs to everyone. So it's like you take a shortcut around the walls of a house because that's easier for where you're going. And I kind of like it. I'm sort of it grows on you, the feeling that there's no private property
Are you
outside of.
accepting? Are you accepting immigrants or refugees?
I think that's pretty strict. If you have a work permit and stuff, then you can come here and work for that employer. But it's like special rules for Scandinavians and stuff. So yeah, it's a lot of things to look into.
So the fences are invisible.
Yeah, and nobody. Of course, there are some fences around, some old colonial gardens down by the fjord and stuff. But that's like more like to keep the plants in, I think. It almost seems because you have some trees and some gardens and stuff. I don't know. But it's basically people don't have fences, and yeah, joggers. People who are running, orienteering, or whatever, they just run around the houses, you know, take shortcuts all over. And if you're going over the hill over to the main hospital, you just take the shortest way up the bedrock, up the hill, and between the houses. And nobody ever. I used to sort of feel that I was intruding or trespassing when I did that, because you sort of walk on people's staircases and stuff in outside their houses, but you know, there's nothing wrong about it. Everybody does it, and it's just the law of the land, or the lack thereof, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's great. The whole ownership thing, I always sort of intuited from the time I was a little kid, was just so screwed up. It seemed to, on the very basic level, just fail sort of the pros and cons list. I mean,
well, what do kids do? They trespass. They're always crossing fences and going to neighbors' gardens to steal fruit. And the kids, they never respect that.
Yeah, no, they don't care. But even when you see them start to take ownership of things or say, this is my toy or whatever, it almost always leads to disagreement between the kids themselves. It seems to engender a lot more negativity than it does.
But it's because they're taught that, because they tell them that's yours. But they, I'm nearly sure that you know, if they were never told anything about it, there wouldn't be any such thing as fighting over my toy. No, I know. I can see animals, when they have something that they really like, they defend it. I don't know if it come out of a sense of ownership, though. I think it's more, it's another purpose. But you know, a lot of this idea of mine is alien cortex is parents, society created, and yeah, totally.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of an interesting story I read that was based on actual observation of bald eagles. So in like their migration, they'd gather at like, I can't remember this lake's name, but they had a lot of fish. It was all plentiful, so all the eagles were just lounging. And the new arrivals would be hungry, right? So they'd start fishing. And then the eagles that were fed and full, they would fly out and knock the fish out of their talons or steal them. And it turns out they were just doing that to, like, fuck with the newcomers. They were just playing with them. And because they wanted to fly. Yeah, it wasn't a whole domination thing. They were just bored. They were just bored and wanted to play.
It's so funny. When I was a kid, I used to really love reading about animals and all this. And I've noticed just in the short time since I was a kid that so many of the assumptions of animal behavior are all through the lens of the alien cortex. So they always think everything's about domination and competition and stuff like that. But it's very funny, even in just the matter of years, how often they have to switch the story because their explanation for something is, yeah, it's a dispute or whatever. And then they see another example of supposedly the same thing where, yeah, it turns out they're just playing. It's so funny. I see it happen time and time and time and time and time again. They're always wrong.
Yeah, and the nature documentaries where they say competition like 50 times, like, it's so ridiculous. Bad. I can't watch nature documentaries anymore because they'd be on this spiel about competition, and the birds are just sitting in the tree singing. It's like, dude, get over it. Get over it.
You have to watch it on mute. Yeah, it's ludicrous.
Yeah, I should watch it on mute and play some classical music. It'd be way better.
Totally, 100%. I think Hugh said it once, but if you just go out into nature and try to see this cutthroat tooth and nail competition, you're going to be out there for a very, very long time. It's just not how things work.
Yeah, not at all. And it's like I saw this one video with this raven messing with this rat. Like the raven would pull the rat's tail and drag him a little bit and flap around to the other side. And the person was talking about how cruel that was, but the rat would jump at the raven. They were playing. They were fucking playing. Get over
I've
it.
seen the same thing with a cat. Yeah, the ravens really love to do that. There's tons of them around here, and they're super interesting animals.
Yeah.
They
Yeah, I think that is a sign of like real intelligence is when like a creature is playful like that and trying to have some fun.
I've seen them not in real life, but I've seen them on video pitting two cats against each other sometimes. So one will have its back turned to the other, and then they'll jump up behind it, and then they'll pull its tail to make it look like the other cat did it, and they'll just keep going back and forth between the two of them until they start fighting with each other. But it's not really a serious fight. It's like kind of nasty. It's not cruel or anything, but it is kind of funny. It's evident that they're getting entertainment out of it.
Yeah, they're trolling. They're fucking trolling.
Don't the hunter gatherers spend about three quarters of their time playing too? Because they don't, that's what most anthropologists would conclude of their lifestyle. So, they have plenty of time for that.
Yeah.
Being
Yeah, the idea that
the
you
best.
need to be busy 24/7 is just not true. Again, go out into nature and show me an animal that's busy 24/7. They spend most of their time hanging out, like any animal does. You have to work when you have to work, of course, but it's necessary for life. When the predator is chasing you, you gotta haul ass. But yeah, it's a compulsion we have in our culture, in a slave culture that's indoctrinated to be working and productive 24/7. And in your downtime, you have to be doing stuff that, is conducive for productivity, all that kind of jazz. How to sleep like a, most efficiently, all that stuff. It's nonsense.
Well, I'm going to have to leave you because I have an animal there who wants to go out. So I have
Sure.
to obey the law of the nose.
Yeah, exactly. That's perfect.
And I have to continue my lying around and gazing at the window. So I'll be busy all afternoon doing that.
Yeah, no, that's a good place to call it, I think.
Should we end it? Yeah. All right, so let's just fall still for a moment. And we'll end it with Om Param Mat Mane Nama Iti. All right. Thank you, everybody, for joining.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
guys.